Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 2 of Stop Telling Me to Relax. For this episode, I wanted to talk to my friend Brittany. She is a mother of 6, single mother of 6, foster mother, adopted mother. I think once you're a foster mom, you're kind of always a foster mom, but you're a foster mom, adopted 2 children from foster care, and then you have biological children as well. So before we get into all that, why don't you just introduce yourself?
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Of course, yeah. So just to be honest, like this is our second time recording because the first time that we recorded this, maybe like a few weeks ago, my audio was echoing from my microphone. And so we're recording this again. So just, you know, put it all out there. So that's probably why we're maybe laughing a little bit because it's like round 2. I hope this goes well. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead. Why don't you introduce
Okay, so my name's Brittany, and I will be 35 next month. I'm originally from San Diego. I grew up in Fresno and now reside in Visalia, California with my family.
Nice, nice.
I have 6 children.
Yep. Yeah.
We only planned on 4, but we ended with 6, so.
Yeah. Life happens.
It happens.
Or you have, like, I don't want to say pushy social workers, but you've got.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, go ahead, adopt them.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how we met was back, what was it, 2018 or 19? It was before COVID, so
yeah,
19, maybe 18. Brittany was a foster parent with an agency that I worked at. I was a social worker and recruiter for the agency, and that's how we met.
Yep.
So let's start with just a little bit about your family background. You said, you know, you're from San Diego, but raised here in the Central Valley. Just tell us a little bit about your background because you are a survivor. You've been through a lot just in your childhood. So let's talk about that.
Okay. So like I said, I'm from San Diego. My parents met my dad was stationed in the Navy there. And my dad got out of the Navy shortly after they met, and they had I'm like 1 of 5. So they had 5 children and almost seemed like they didn't know exactly how to handle 5. And
it's a lot.
Reverted to drugs and alcohol and kind of were partying a lot. And we ended up in foster care. My aunt, who lives in San Diego, was really kind of their support system who kind of helped us. Like we lived with her for a period of time. We lived in foster homes for a period of time. And our parents actually got us back relatively quick, which I was surprised. But our home life was pretty rough. I call it like survival of the fittest. We rarely had food in our house. There at one point, our door was off the hinges. Our front door was off the hinges. Wow. Just infested with just bugs and mice and just really kind of dirty living situation, even, you know, from when I was really little. Mm-hmm. Something interesting is when I became a foster parent, I actually requested my foster care file from San Diego County, and I was able to read it. And it kind of explained to me a lot of why I am the way I am today, or the reason why, you know, who I am today. It was pretty intense. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, you sent me like a couple of pages of it, and it's wild.
I think, you know, through working with a therapist, I have realized that I have a lot of blocked trauma because I don't actually remember a good chunk of what had happened when we were in care. So, you know, but there were all kinds of reports of how dirty the house was. You know, a social worker walked in and my brother was in his car seat drinking a bottle with like rotten milk in it. And just, you know, there's another report saying like, it seems to me that my dad loves drugs more than he loves his own children. Like a social worker stated that. And mm-hmm. It was tough to read, but I was glad that I read it because it allowed me to be able to bond with my kids, my foster kids on a deeper level, I think, than most other foster parents. Because I lived a part of the story that may be similar to theirs, you know?
Right.
So being able to have that opportunity to kind of know where I came from was pretty interesting and unique. But I actually, I didn't really know much about my childhood and I didn't remember a lot because my mom passed away when I was 14 from her addiction. And
you want to tell a little, if you don't mind sharing, like the story behind how she died and how it happened.
So we moved to Fresno when I was about, I think I was 10 or 11 years old.
Okay.
And my mom wanted this new life. She wanted to start off fresh with her kids. My oldest brother was living in with his grandparents in Oakhurst. So Fresno was kind of a good central spot to be kind of in between where he was at in Oakhurst with his grandparents and also with her sister, who was a huge, one of our biggest support systems, even now that she's been gone. She, when we moved here, she was hoping for that, you know, that she'd always said that she wanted, you know, the perfect American dream family with her white picket fence and all of that with her husband and kids. And, and when, you know, drugs and alcohol found her, it was like, she couldn't let that go. And so moving was kind of a fresh start for her. My mom was really, really trying to stay sober, but you know, her only experience besides being a stay-at-home mom was bartending. And so she ended up finding a bar, and she was actually sober for almost a year. And they had gotten clean in 1997 from drugs, and they had stayed clean for a long time and then started drinking again. And that's kind of, that kind of became their drug, was the alcohol. And they were still drinking by the time we moved to Fresno, and she was trying to stay sober, and my dad kind of wasn't. And really, when you go through something like that, you kind of have to be all in. And my dad wasn't ready to quit. But they stayed together through it all. And eventually my mom started drinking again, and she started drinking pretty heavily. I remember there was one point where she went down to live with my Aunt Joyce in San Diego, who is the same aunt I've been talking about already, for several months, because my Aunt Joyce doesn't drink and is like, you know, she's her big sister. So she's always been there for us and been there for her especially. And she adores my mom, adored her, and just really wanted her to be healthy for us. And so she really, really tried. And I think when you're in your addiction, you kind of have to hit that rock bottom in order for you off. And my dad wasn't quite there yet.
Right.
So when he came back up or when my mom came back up to live with us, she really tried hard to stay sober, but it just didn't happen. And then started drinking pretty heavily and kind of felt ashamed of herself. She didn't want her children to see her that way. So she kind of stayed in her room and was kind of a hermit. Like, we rarely saw her. I didn't even see her come out to use the restroom. Like, how much she would stay in her room.
So she's really struggling with depression then.
Yeah. And you know, back in the day, depression, but my mom was bipolar, and they didn't really have a lot of, like, my parents were really, really, really like, you know, therapists are just after you for your money. You just go and talk to them, and you know, they like, what is somebody that doesn't even know me going to do, kind of thing. Right. Like, my parents were always like that, which is kind of silly now, cause I'm going to school to be one. So I'm going to school for the same thing that they were like shunning, you know, growing up. But, so she was in there for quite a long time. And we only had one bathroom. So to not see her come out to use the restroom was kind of crazy.
So she didn't work then. Your dad was the one working,
she actually started. She was working as a bartender at Chukchansi Gold Casino, and was wanting to switch her career to dealing poker, so that way she could get away from the alcohol. And so she was kind of in that transition when she started drinking heavily, and then just decided she wasn't going to go to work anymore. And so it was probably like a good month or so of her just binge drinking in her bedroom by herself. And I walked in because she had given me her engagement ring that my dad had given her, and told me to hang on to it because she's not going to be able to have it for while she's in and out of hospitals, because she was going in and out of the hospital to get help. And then she'd check herself out because she was, you know, wanting to drink. And then, so I went in to take her ring to put it in her jewelry box. And because she was the type, like, don't wake her up because she'll get mad. So I just put it in her jewelry box. And I was kind of looking at her and she kind of looked odd. And so I went over there and she had been deceased. And, you know, I was looking for a pulse and stuff and I couldn't find one. So I called my older brother who was, I think he was 19 at the time. And he came in. We were looking for a pulse. I called my dad and he didn't answer. So then I called 911 and I, you know, kind of went off, was like kind of in a panic at that moment. And they asked us to roll her on her back. And they predicted she had been gone for several hours, but we hadn't known because she was always in there. And so we didn't want the other siblings to have to see that because it was traumatizing. So we kind of blocked off the room so they didn't have to see that. And and then I called my dad and he answered the phone and I told him and he thought I was joking and I wasn't. And he gets home and he forgot to put the car in park. He just jumped out of the car without putting it in park. So then he had to run after the car, put the car in park,
Goodness.
Yeah, it was crazy. It's crazy how I remember that night so vividly, you know, and it
how
really,
old were you?
14.
14. Okay.
Yeah. I was a freshman in high school. It really kind of puts life into perspective having to, to witness something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But, and then after that, it was like everything, our whole life just flipped upside down. You know, my mom had been the main caretaker of us most of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad worked graveyard shifts and slept all day. And so he gained 5 kids and he had absolutely like no idea what to do with us.
Yeah.
And so history kind of repeated itself from back when we were younger. Where, you know, we lived in filth and we didn't have food in the house and, you know, our house was infested with rats and it just really, really unsafe, unhealthy living environment. We had broken windows and I mean, it was crazy.
Was CPS involved at all during that time after your mom passed? And it was just,
yes,
they
so,
were.
We lived pretty close to an elementary school and my sister and my younger brother actually went there and they kind of could see our house from where the school was. Uh-huh. And they had called CPS quite a few times on us. But they would show up and my dad would be like, oh, I'm just heading out, you know, can you come back? And I think at that point, they had like 72 hours to respond to it. So like he would say, we have, you know, he has an appointment he's running out to, can they come back? And so then they would come back within 72 hours. And so in that 72 hours, we would clean the house. He would get the water turned back on. He would put the front door back on the hinges. You know, he would make the house look presentable and then they'd come out and then, you know, and as a foster kid who's been in foster care before, your parents who have an addiction or suffer from addiction, they kind of train you to know what to say to a social worker so that you don't get taken away.
Right.
And, you know, one of the biggest things when you have parents who are addicts is like, do you want to go live with strangers or do you want to live with your parents? You know, so this is what you need to say to that social worker in order to stay living here kind of thing, you're going to go live with strangers, you know? So, even now, like we've heard stories about how, you know, I've heard stories about how, yeah, my parents are, you see it in even in the movies and shows I've seen, like where kids are like saying certain things so that they're not taken away from their parents. And that's exactly how it was when, you know, back in the day when, after my mom had died, is like, even before my mom had died, you know, there was reports that they felt like my brother was being coached on what to say to a social worker. 'Cause he was like 7 at the time.
Yeah.
And, so yeah, it's intense.
It actually is just like being a child being separated from their parents and their family and the, you know, the only home they know is almost like just as traumatic as the trauma itself. That is the reason for them being removed. So, yeah. As hard as it is, you know, for like CPS has a job to do to make sure children are safe in their homes. And if they're not, then, you know, remove them. Yeah. But it's also, you're also then adding on another layer of trauma when you're taking them from their parents and putting them in a house with essentially strangers they don't know. Even if they're loving and kind and taking care of all their needs, they're still strangers to them. So that's just another layer of trauma.
I felt like we were one of those families who slipped through the cracks. Like mm-hmm. we were reunified with our parents, but probably shouldn't have been reunified.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because there is a lot more trauma that has happened. And I feel like actually, you know, I would have suffered through trauma even if I had aged out of foster care or even if I had been adopted or, you know, there still would have been some sort of trauma.
Yeah.
It would have been different than what I experienced with my parents. But, you know, just I do feel like we were kind of the ones that slipped through the cracks. Like we shouldn't have been reunified, or they should have given my parents more time to get clean and sober. Or did check-ins, or, you know, the system mm-hmm. is so broken that
it is.
Even nowadays it's broken. So I can mm-hmm. imagine like how, you know, what holes there were, you know, 25 years ago or whatever it was. So it was about a year after my mom passed away. My dad started dating another woman who had 3 kids at the time. And so we were in a house with 8 children.
Oh,
wow. It was probably a year, less than 2 years that my dad had moved on and moved in with somebody else. And
I can't imagine that went over very well.
Yeah. And so a lot of times it was either like the girls were fighting against the boys or my siblings were fighting against the other kids. And so even now there's still some like animosity towards
your dad is still
like, he's not, and I'll get to that.
Okay.
Cause that just happened pretty recent. But the siblings, you know, once we all turned 18, we kind of all just went our separate ways. And I still talk to my immediate siblings, but I don't talk to any of her kids.
Okay.
But it was a lot. It was a lot.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot.
Getting 3 new siblings after our mom had just passed away recently. And so it was a lot, but I feel like my dad kind of needed her to help him figure out what he was supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
You know, and
we needed help with 5 kids. I mean, that's a lot to do on your own, and men don't have those. Some of those instincts like to
yeah. And she kind of came about like it kind of, she moved in because my dad ended up in jail because he relapsed on drugs and alcohol.
Okay.
And so we were there by ourselves while our dad was in jail, and she kind of helped put food in the house and mm-hmm. And so I thought things were going to be different than the way they were when she was with us, but mm-hmm. it almost felt like she did everything to make us like her and then decided she was going to do whatever, you know, after we were okay with her being there with her kids, it was like, then it almost felt like she would favor her kids over the rest of us. Her family would favor her kids over the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad would almost, it was almost as if she had this, like, I don't know how to say it without using a specific word that's probably not appropriate for a podcast, but kind of almost had him whipped into
having on him or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She had him whipped into treating.
Oh, I think I know what you're going to say.
Yeah.
Yes.
treating her kids better than he treated his own. Mm-hmm. And it sucked, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, as soon as I turned 18, I was out.
Yeah.
And she even like had told us, like, when you turn 18, you move out, you can't come back.
She said that
we don't have space for you.
I
was like, don't worry, I don't plan on coming back, but how come your kids have come back several times?
Right.
Several times. So it's okay for your kids to come back, but it's not okay for his. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But I was just like, yeah, I was just like, okay.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, good riddance. I don't know. Yeah. I wouldn't even want to live there anyway.
Yeah. It was pretty intense. I moved out like 3 days after my 18th birthday, and I moved in with my friend, my best friend at the time, and her mom was kind of the one that helped me especially be able to, you know, get that kind of like a halfway house, not like a halfway house, but like kind of like a halfway mark to becoming a full adult. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
she was like a surrogate mom kind of.
Yeah. So yeah. She was the one that kind of helped us, like, how do you pay bills and how do you, mm-hmm. you know, you have to pay this and you have to pay that. And you know, like, kind of gave me the opportunity to be able to grow up before I moved on out to my own, on my own. And so in 2013, my dad almost died from alcohol poisoning. Mm-hmm. He had cirrhosis of the liver really bad and had jaundice and was kind of in and out of consciousness. And his doctor told him, like, if you have another drop of alcohol, you will die. Mm-hmm. And he's like, that was enough for me to drop the bottle. And he was sober. Yes. So he was sober for, I think, from 2013 to 2020. So 7 years. 7 years he was sober. And in 2020, when the pandemic hit, he started drinking again and continued drinking. When he was in his drinking binges, I would not speak to him. Even mm-hmm. like when I got married, I told him if he's not going to be sober, he's not invited. And so I asked my Aunt Joyce, who I talked about earlier, to walk me mm-hmm. down the aisle.
Mm-hmm. Was your wedding alcohol free?
It wasn't.
It wasn't. Okay.
It wasn't. Because I, you know, we had other people that had joined us who wanted to enjoy it, you know, mm-hmm. and I didn't drink, but
you want everybody to have fun.
Yes. And, so I kind of felt bad because I didn't actually tell him I was getting married until like 2 weeks prior. But I told him I had a feeling I was going to regret it if I didn't have him there. So,
or at least
I called him. Yeah. I called him and I told him, hey, I'm getting married in 2 weeks. I would like you to go, but I want you to be sober. And if you can't be sober, then I don't want you to come. And so he came and he seemed like he was doing good. He was sober for the most part. And then when the reception came, he started drinking again and it really upset me. And I expressed that. And so he was like, I didn't realize you wanted me to stay sober the entire time and this and that. I'm sorry, whatever. So he did pretty good. Yeah. But that was at my wedding in 2016.
Okay.
When did I get married? I can't even remember.
Could it have been 16? Maybe.
No, 2013.
14? I wouldn't know. We didn't know each other then. I don't know.
Yeah, it was 2013. I was June 16th, 2013. And then shortly after that, after we got married, is when he had his health scare and decided to be sober. So, and then in 2020, you know, the pandemic hit and everybody's flipping out and he felt the pressure and relapsed and started drinking again and continued to drink. And so, and then when he was sober, I would tell him, you know, I would allow him to be as involved as he wanted to be, but you know, we've been through it a million times about I'm sober, I'm not sober, I'm sober, I'm not sober. It's been, that's been our whole life, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to put somebody in my children's lives who could potentially leave them. So I wanted to protect my heart. I wanted to protect their heart. And so I would allow him to be as involved as he wants to be even now. If he wants, as now that he's sober again, if he wants to be involved, I allow him to be, but I don't put pressure on the relationship between him and I, or put pressure on a relationship between him and my kids, because I don't know what the future holds.
Yeah.
And so he started drinking again and then recently got so depressed that he tried to commit suicide.
This is recently, like within the last couple of years. Okay.
Yes. And that was probably the lowest he's ever been. Mm-hmm. And after that happened, his wife left him. Mm-hmm. And which I feel like, you know, she was trying to get sober, mm-hmm. which is good for her.
Right.
But now that he also wanted to get sober, I felt like, well, you enabled him for so long. How come you don't want to help him now that he wants to get sober and he's depressed and he needs help? And now you're going to leave him at his most vulnerable state. Right. And so I lost respect for her a long time ago. But mm-hmm. So he ended up living in a rehab facility. He's a veteran. So he actually got a lot of good benefits being a veteran, and has been the first time living by himself, paying his own bills and buying his own, preparing his own food and cleaning his own house. I think he's like, I think since like, this is the first time in my entire life that I've actually like to live by myself. And he's sober and we go and visit him and I take him gifts and, you know, he spends time with my kids and wants to. And so we have a pretty good relationship now. And I'm, you know, I've always said, like, I hope for the best, but prepare for the worst.
Yeah.
That's just always kind of been my survival mechanism my entire life.
Yeah.
That's just how it is. But
yeah. So you mentioned your wedding. So let's go there and talk about your ex-husband and your marriage. And then your family becoming foster parents. So we won't say his name. We're going to do our best not to say his name. But how did you meet your ex-husband? Talk a little bit about how you met, what your life was like when you were dating.
So I met him in 2010. Actually, it was probably 2009. It was shortly after his oldest daughter was born.
Okay.
So it was 2009. I think we started dating April of 2010. I was always that kind of the person that was like, well, I've been hurt in every single aspect of life besides like a boyfriend. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't looking for a boyfriend. I had never dated anybody. I'd never kissed anybody. I was like 19 years old and the only person out of my friend group who had never been kissed, you know? And so kind of that, like, what would they call? They used to call me a square. Like I was the one that was always like making sure I was being good and following the rules and don't want to get in trouble, paranoid to like, you know, do something wrong. And
like a trauma response too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to protect my heart in that aspect because I had seen my sister, my parents, my friends get hurt in relationships. And I didn't want to be that, you know, I didn't want to be a part of that story. And so it took me a while to kind of bring those guards down to allow him in, but he stayed. So I was pretty impressed. That he was interested enough to stay. And the one thing that I was
chatted for a little while, cause you met online, right?
Yeah. Well, so it was, we call it MySpace to my place. So it was a platform before Facebook.
Yeah. If you're born after like a certain age, you're not going to really know MySpace and the impact, but a lot of people met people on MySpace. Yeah,
he actually lived in Lindsay, California, which I had never heard of until I met him. And I was living in Fresno and I had just graduated high school and started attending Fresno State. And he was coming here to also attend college with his best friend and roommate. And he wanted to meet people. And I actually
Lindsay's what next to it's right next to Tulare.
Yeah, it's about 30 minutes from Visalia, like east of Visalia.
Okay.
And so I had been really rude to him because he tried to add me and I'm like, how do I know you're not some old man? Yeah. Like, who are you? How do I know you're not some old man just like trying to hit on young girls? And just so rude to him. And he was like, I'm just trying to meet people, like, cause I don't know anybody in Fresno. And I'm like, whatever, dude. And, but he kept on. And I actually really enjoyed talking to him. And my best friend at the time, my roommate, was like, Brittany, you don't ever let anybody in. And if you enjoy talking to this guy, you need to let those guards down and just talk to him. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to mean that you're going to be boyfriend, girlfriend. It doesn't mean that you guys are going to, you know. And so I think that conversation with her kind of what led to, okay, I'll just, you know, we'll see what happens. And so we had been talking for a few months, and we would, I really respected him because, you know, even after a month of talking, he was like, I just want to let you know, I have a daughter. And if that's a deal breaker, then that's a deal breaker. And I was like, you know, I'd always loved kids, like since I was little.
Yeah.
If you ever asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, it was a mom or a pediatrician.
Me and too. So, I really wanted to be a pediatrician too, or a mom. And yeah, I love children too. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, he told me about his kid. And I was like, I love kids. Mm-hmm. I always have. And that's not a deal breaker for me at all. And so then we just continued chatting. We met at Fashion Fair Mall, which, you know, Fashion Fair Mall. Yeah. I worked there at the time. I worked at Forever 21. And
it's so crazy. I probably ran into you.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I was there like 3.5 years. So you probably did.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
So,
and it's going out of business, which is so sad.
I know.
Funny, yesterday we were at the Tulare outlets with my son, and I was like, oh, I want to go to the Forever 21 because I know they're going out of business, and so there's probably sales or whatever. But they were already closed. Like, that one's already done. Closed.
Oh, yeah.
No, yeah, it's already done.
That's crazy.
I think the one at Fashion Fair is still maybe still open. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, we need to make a Forever 31 now. So
we do.
Like leggings and comfy clothes.
Leggings. Quiet comfy music.
Sweaters. Yeah.
Coffee. Books.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had worked there at the time, and I had had a lot of friends at the mall. And so I was like, that's where I kind of would be comfortable meeting him because it's in a public place. A lot of the people there I know. And so, so we met there. And then we just hit it off, and we went and had a Jamba Juice down there, like down there by Fresno State. And and then we just went to my apartment and watched a movie, and that was that, you know. Yeah. And the rest is just like history. He's always been, even now, I'll tell you, he's always been a great person. And he just makes decisions sometimes that aren't the best decisions. Mm-hmm. And but he's different from like most men, I guess. Like in society, men are perceived like, you know, they just want to get in your pants and they just want, you know, and so it didn't feel like that when I met him. And, and I mean, we just hung out as much as we could and just kind of just hit it off from there. And so that was in 2010. I met his daughter shortly after that. She was probably 8 months old, I think, when I the first day I met her. And just this chubby, cute little bundle of goodness. And and even now, like, I just tell people, she's my kid. She's always been my kid. She's going to continue to be my kid no matter what, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was our first baby. Her name is Aliyah, and she's beautiful and 15 now. And I can't believe that.
Yeah.
And then in 2012 at my company party, I had worked at this company for several years, and the people there had become my family. And so he knew that that was probably the perfect place to propose to me at. And so he proposed to me in front of 120 people.
Oh, whoa.
At my company.
I'd be kind of embarrassed. Not embarrassed.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
He's like, I was eating. I was taking shots. And then when it was time, I was so drunk that I needed to, like, eat some bread to help soak it up. And so I was going around asking people, are you going to eat your bread roll? Are you going to eat your bread roll? Are you going to eat your bread roll? Because he's like, I was so nervous. After the proposal, you told me this story. Asking everybody for their bread rolls so he could sober up a little bit. His best friend was somebody that I had worked with, his best friend at the time. And so he had done like a little speech thing and then interrupted his speech to kind of give the microphone to. So nobody knew about it except him and his best friend.
Oh, okay.
And then proposed to me in front of everybody. And then we got married that following June on Father's Day.
Oh,
so, and then we were together for a long time, all the way up until May of last year was the day our divorce was finalized.
Mm-hmm.
So it's already been almost a year. That's crazy.
That's, yeah, it goes by fast. I believe I was the one, was it me or was it somebody else that wrote your like home study?
I think it was you.
Me, yeah. And if for people that aren't in the foster care world, when a family wants to become certified as a foster parent, the certification is through the state, and the foster agency that they're working with has to write what's called a home study. And yeah, it's a series of interviews that the foster family does with a social worker who's going to write the home study. And it's basically just a comprehensive report on who the family is, who each foster parent is, what their life looks like, a lot of their background and history on things that have happened to them, good and bad, that kind of have led them to this point where they want to become a foster family home. So I believe I wrote that for you. And I remember with your ex-husband, there was just a lot of like childhood trauma and just past trauma that really still affects him to this day. And I think that's, you know, that's part of, I'm assuming, I don't know. I obviously don't know him as well as you do. And, but just some of the struggles that he's had in his past are just affecting his mental health now. And that's the result is like what's kind of going on now. But deep down, he is a good person and a good man.
He is.
Yeah.
And I tell people that today, we've had our problems, we've had our issues, but he really is a good person. And I think you're exactly right. There was a point in our relationship where his mental health was really declining. And I think at that moment I wasn't as prepared to support him as much as I probably should have in his mental health struggle, because I had been going through my own battles.
Yeah.
And, you know, from postpartum depression with our first child. And I was kind of feeling like I was finally getting my head above water. And then his mental health started decline. And started to decline.
You're talking about your ex-husband.
Yes.
Okay.
And so it was, I was kind of in that mindset where I was just starting to feel better and now he's struggling. And so I, you know, and one of the things I think that was hard with our relationship is that I communed everything, like every piece of everything that was in my life. I gave him all of me, but he wasn't giving me that same respect back. So his mental health would decline, but he wouldn't share with me why he was so upset or why he was struggling, or he'd give me bits and pieces of it, or, you know, and then his anger would get really bad. And then I would kind of go in this freeze mode. They say you go in fight, flight, or freeze. And it's like, I would freeze up because I didn't know how to handle it. And my mom, when she was not sober, she would get really angry. And so it was kind of a trauma response where I would just freeze. And so not being able to handle that, I think, was kind of where not being able to handle his mental health decline while kind of struggling with my own, it was hard. And it was kind of, that's where the communication lacked as well.
In the midst,
We still lasted a pretty long time during that.
We did. I mean, it's been since you guys have met, you said April, 2010, that's 15 years. That's a long time. It's a long time. So that's why, you know, with divorce and marriages, relationships, I mean, yeah, it came to an end, and it's definitely not ideal and it's definitely hard, but to make a relationship last for, you know, a long time and get married and buy homes and have kids and you guys fostered and adopted, I mean, there's still a lot of good things that came from it.
Yeah. I think the hardest struggle for me was that, you know, there's this term going around that's called, that people say is a married single mom. And as the more kids we got, the harder it was for me to maintain this lifestyle that I wanted for the kids and doing everything for them, like, you know, as well as taking care of the house and paying all the bills and you know, doing all the kids' doctor's appointments and therapy visits and social worker visits and, you know, everything with school, all of the activities that they like to do and all of that, it was all falling on me, which still I take on the brunt of it, but not a feeling like this single mom while you're married was kind of really hard for me. And that's what people would tell me, like, Brittany, you're like, cause I'm like, I'm scared. Like, what happens if I leave? And, you know, and they're like, Brittany, you're already doing it all by yourself.
Right.
And that kind of was where it opened up my eyes. Like, Brittany, you're doing it by yourself. Like, you don't need him. You're already doing it, you know? And but I didn't want that. I didn't want that for us. I didn't want that for our kids. I didn't want to not be married. Mm-hmm. I wanted to work on it. I really did.
It's understandable. I mean, it's like ups and downs are going to happen and marriage relationships. It's to be expected. So, you know, to want to try to work things out is totally understandable.
And then
let's piggyback a little bit to, I guess, the discussion between you and your ex-husband to become foster parents. What was his initial response to the idea? And I mean, you've mentioned a little bit about how the impact of it, what that impact was on your marriage, but what was that discussion like to even do it in the first place?
So when we first decided to do it, we were in a pretty good place in our marriage. We were we had been trying to conceive our first child for a few years and ultimately we weren't able to conceive without help. And so we had decided to foster kids until one came up for adoption. One was eligible to a child became eligible to adopt. Because we weren't sure if we were going to be able to have our own children or not. And my sister, who was struggling with her own addiction, had a child who was really young at the time. I had kind of felt like she was going to end up in our home at some point.
Okay.
And so it was kind of like there was two pathways we were going. We weren't sure if we were going to have kids. We knew my niece at some point was going to come live with us. And so we just felt like I felt like that was probably a good path for us to take is foster care, because if we can't conceive our own child, let's love on a child who may not have somebody to love them. And so, he still wasn't all on board with it. And I think part of it was because of his own trauma. He didn't want to, in his words, like mess up a child even more than what he was already messed up. Like he was already messed up. So he didn't want to mess up another child. Like, he felt like he wasn't good enough for this to raise this child. And so like, he felt like he was going to bring more trauma to them if he had raised them. And so, and I didn't feel like that at all, because he, like we've said, is like, he's such a good person.
Yeah. He
is. And, so I was like, just go to the orientation. Let's just go to the orientation. We'll see what it's about. And then we will decide what we want to do moving forward. And he was like, okay. And we did the orientation. There was this one video that you had showed us.
Yeah, that video is pretty powerful. I have spoken to other foster parents who I showed that video to in the orientation. And that video was something that kind of solidified for them that they wanted to foster. It really, really hit their heart. I can't remember what the video is titled. I'll find it. I'll have to find it on YouTube, and I'll put it like in the episode notes of this video if anybody wants to watch the video. But it's just a story. I think there's two parts, actually. A story about a little girl who is removed from the care of her mother due to domestic violence. She has a little brother, and it just kind of shows the story of her in and out of foster homes and her mom trying to get custody. It's pretty powerful. It's a good video to watch, even if you don't want to foster, just to watch it. It's very accurate about the experience of being in care for a child.
Yeah, it was really inspiring for us.
Yeah.
And for him especially, it kind of hit him in the heart. And that's when he had made that his decision that he wanted to do it. And so that's when we had moved forward.
Okay.
So we had thought about fostering. We conceived our child. We had our child, and then we started fostering after.
Okay. Because your old Carter was, what, like 3 when you started fostering?
Yeah.
Yeah. He was little.
Yeah,
so,
he was little. We started going through the process, I think, even before he turned 3. Because okay. when we got Penelope and Jackson, they were 3 and 4.
Okay.
No, they were 2 and 3. And then, wow. yeah, because they were having their birthdays. They were 2 and 3 years old when we first got Penelope and Jackson. And so that's when we started fostering. We got our first placement, which was 2 boys with autism. Thank you.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
Thank you, Veronica.
Those boys had a lot of needs that, like, like entry level basic foster home could not meet. But you, yes. I mean, you guys did a great job until it was way too much. That those boys were, I don't even think they talked.
There was one that was verbal, one was nonverbal.
Yeah,
they were 5 and 7, and they had not had a diagnosis, but we had known that they had autism.
Their mom wasn't even sending them to school. They weren't in school. Yeah. They had never been to school, I don't think.
They had no services. Yeah. Nothing.
Yeah.
They weren't fully potty trained. And my ex-husband and I have, you know, we were both working full time. So it was really hard for us to be able to handle 2 boys with autism.
Yeah.
When we're getting called out of work for so many times.
Yeah.
And so ultimately we ended up having to put in a notice on those kids.
Mm-hmm. I'll never forget that, you know, when you put a notice and then there's that meeting with social services, with all the parties involved. And that meeting was mom was there, their biological mom was there. Just everybody who had their hands in the pot was there. And it was just, I'll just never forget that meeting because I don't feel like the mother really understood how bad her children were struggling.
Yeah.
And yeah, maybe they may have had autism. They may have had some other things, issues that were undiagnosed. But a lot of it was from her neglect. And that was their response to the trauma they experienced. And I don't feel like she got it. Like, and it's wild to me to see how somebody can see their kids in that state it was just wild. I don't know. I'll just never forget that meeting.
It was hard for us, you know, because they didn't go outside very often. And so when we had to take them to doctor's visits and stuff, they would just open the car door and just like run off. So we ended up having to get them these little backpacks. And I mean, when they first came to our house, they're like jumping on our kitchen table and climbing on the counters. And like,
it's like they had never been in the real world. It was like they never, you know, mom had never taken them out anywhere and been like, okay, we're going to cross the street, look both ways, stop, wait till the little walk.
Yeah, no sense of security.
None of it. Like, I have never seen
anything like that before.
Yeah, it was really wild.
Yeah. So once they went to a home that was better suited for them, an intensive care foster home for them.
I think they were adopted. I remember hearing mom.
Oh, really? That's cool.
Yeah. Mom didn't reunify and then somebody adopted them. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We had been waiting and waiting and waiting. And then January the following year, we got a call to take a sibling placement, a little boy and a little girl that were 2 and 3. So we ended up getting the first placement, which happens to be our children now, Jackson and Penelope.
Yeah.
And they are currently 7 and 9.
You guys have adopted.
And they're adopted. Yes.
Bio mom no longer has any of her parental rights. So let's talk about just the experience of adopting them. I guess the process of them like acclimating to being in your family. And then what is the relationship like with the biological mother? I know, but tell everybody else. Okay, so we're going to stop there. Like it says in the title, this is going to be a 2-part episode. There will be 2 episodes with Miss Brittany. I just felt like I couldn't condense her story and everything she's been through and everything she has to say into one like 45 minutes to 60 minute video. So this is going to be two parts. And then the second part, we'll continue the conversation about adopting two of her kids from foster care, how that adoption and the, I guess, stress and responsibility of that affected her marriage. We'll talk about the, you know, kind of beginning and of the end and demise of her marriage leading to divorce and what her life looks like now with her ex-husband still living together in the same home with six of their kids and some future plans, future goals that she has. Thanks for listening to part one, and I hope that you click on part two and enjoy that episode as well. Thanks.